Now, did Doug and Jim know each other?
No. We could establish no connection between the two victims or why they would be out there at the same time. Just appears that they went out hunting, were in the wrong place at the wrong time. Could have been something planned, but we couldn't uncover it.
On November 17th, 1990, Doug Estes and Jim Bennett were shot and killed within feet of one another, out in the woods of the Fulton State game area. The two men had arrived at the game area separately and hadn't been hunting together, but they were killed within seconds of one another in the same little patch of woods. What had brought the two of them together that day? Was their meeting intentional or just a chance encounter? Trying to find the answer to this question is why, back in 1990, the detectives had wanted to speak to a man named Gary Kremble. And it's why, in 2020, Jacinda and Susan went to speak to him, too.
I have a seat. I can tell you a whole story about that. Doug was my cousin. We were best friends. And he got shot in the back with a 12-gauge shotgun.
Doug Estes was Gary Kremble's cousin, and the two of them had been close when they were growing up.
He was a very well-liked guy. Everybody called him Festus Estes.
Called him what?
Festus Estes.
Estes. That's a good nickname.
It was a good nickname.
Doug Estes had lived in Comstock, not far from downtown Kalamazoo, but Gary Kremble lived to the south, in a more rural part of the county. He was much closer to the Fulton game area, and much closer to the small town surrounding it, which is how it came to be that Gary Kremble knew both of the victims in this case.
Well, the Bennett, you know, he had a brother too, Terry Bennett. And Terry, they both, them Bennett guys were good people. I used to drink beer with them at that Thunder Hog or whatever it was called. They were just good people.
Since Gary Kremble had known both Doug and Jim, he was probably in the best position to answer the question that, at least initially, was at the forefront of the investigators' minds. Was there some connection between the two victims in this case? Had they known one another?
Them guys never met each other in their life. If they ever did, I would have never known about it. Because they lived in two different worlds, you know. I mean, Jim, he was a Leonidas boy on the Bear Creek. You know, just doing his thing, mellow as can be, in an old beat-down trailer. And Doug was married to Jan at that time. It just didn't click. There's no way.
In some ways, if Doug Estes and Jim Bennett had known one another, this case might be easier to understand. Or it might at least explain why the two had been together when they were killed, even if it couldn't explain who it was that killed them. But in 1990, investigators found no evidence to suggest that Doug and Jim ever encountered one another before. The two men were strangers. So how then did Doug Estes and Jim Bennett end up together in the woods that day, shortly before they were both shot and killed?
Is it possible one of them was a target?
Unlikely, but possible. I would say for either one of them to be a target, it would have to be a professional type hit. Somebody that would actually be, you know, not... Most criminals are pretty lazy. They take, you know, they take the opportunity to do it. It's not like they're going to come out here and set up and wait and, you know, spend a lot of time unless you're a real professional.
In a way, though, it does look like a professional job.
Well, it feels like it could be anything.
Right.
And welcome to Undisclosed. This is episode 2 of our series on the case of the State versus Jeff Titus. My name is Rabia Chaudhary. I'm an attorney and author of the New York Times bestseller, Adnan Story. And I'm here with my colleagues Susan Simpson and Colin Miller.
Hi, this is Susan Simpson. I'm an attorney in Washington, D.C., and I blog at The View from LL2. Hi, this is Colin Miller. I'm an associate dean and professor at the University of South Carolina School of Law, and I blog at Evidence Prof Blog.
If you're trying to find a deer, the Fulton State Game Area is not a bad place to go looking for them. While driving up and down the roads around the game area, I've seen plenty of them cross in front of me, coming in and out of the public hunting land. There are definitely deer there. Jeff Titus's friend, Big Jack Warren, had hunted the state game area back in 1990, not long after Titus's family had moved into the farm on the game area's eastern border. He could confirm, there were deer back then too.
I hunted her that season. I had gotten my buck for this season that year. There was a lot of deer killed there. A lot of nice bucks.
The Bear Creek, or as everyone around here calls it, the Bear Crick, runs through Fulton State Game Area, and it turns much of the game area's 670 acres into swampy wetlands. Which is one reason that it's such a popular hangout for the local deer population.
Well, see, them deer ain't stupid. A lot of people think they are, but they won't. They will dive right into a muck or a little creek, and they'll hide there. And people will just be walking right over them. They can't even see them.
Gary Krimble had hunted the Fulton State game area a time or two, many decades ago, but he'd never been too keen on going back, because although the Fulton State game area has a lot of deer, it also has a lot of something else.
Way too many hunters. Way too many hunters. And these guys had the attitude of, if it's brown, it's down, and all this thing and that thing. And I don't even know what the hell he was even doing out there that day. He knows better than that.
For a lot of hunters, the state game areas are places of last resort. They're where you go to hunt when you don't have access to private land, but are desperate to go hunting anyway. Because the public lands, in addition to being crowded, often draw inexperienced hunters.
You said earlier, if it's brown, it's down. What does that mean?
That's what all these stupid city slickers would use, you know, talking about deer hunting. If it's brown, it's down. You know, they're going to shoot at anything, and they call it, they'd also call it, sound shots. You know, if there was a noise in the brush, shoot. They used to do it all the time. That's why we've had so many hunters dead, you know.
The Fulton State game area has not had any fatal hunting accidents, at least not that I could find record of. But to hear the people down there talk about it, there's been an unending string of near misses and close calls there. And the fact that no accidental deaths have occurred is something of a miracle in itself. And the problem isn't just the city slickers who fire off sound shots at things that may or may not be deer, because experienced hunters who are vying with one another for choice hunting spots can also cause problems. Mark Davis, who in 1990 was Jeff Titus's next-door neighbor, says that's one of the reasons that he no longer goes to the public hunting lands.
Well, you know, it, unfortunately in the hunting world, especially on land like that, conflict is very common. You know, people fight over deer. I shot it first. Well, it ran in front of me and was still alive. I finished it off. It's my deer. No, it's my deer. That's why I don't hunt open areas. I hunt private land only. To see two guys, you know, saying, oh, you're in the wrong spot is not uncommon. For somebody to get shot over it is very uncommon.
Yeah.
I mean, I've seen people get beat up and pushed down and told to get the hell out. But to go to that extreme...
Back in 1990, though, when Mark Davis was younger... he'd still been willing to try hunting on public lands. In fact, on the morning of November 17, 1990, he was actually out hunting in the Fulton State game area. And, as near as he can tell, he was hunting in more or less the exact same spot where, just a few hours later, two hunters would be shot and killed.
I was hunting on state property that was kind of adjoining to my mother-in-law's property. Come to find out, I was about 75 yards from where the incident happened, I came in early because it sounded like World War III out there, and I crawled my ass home.
So you were out hunting that morning, and
yes.
Probably so it's a pretty narrow strip of woods between,
yes.
And it was people were shooting a lot.
Oh yeah, first light. They, unfortunately, state game area, people don't have a lot of places. And a deer come through, and I saw the same deer get hit three times by different hunters. It's like, I gotta get out of here.
Not long after Mark Davis left the game area, a new group of hunters would arrive. It was Doug Estes, who was there for an afternoon of hunting with his friend Mark Perry and his stepson, Bobby Brown.
The hunting trip had been intended as a way to help Mark Perry get his mind off things for a little while. His older brother Ron had recently died, and at the funeral, Mark and Doug Estes had been talking about getting out and going hunting together again, like when they were growing up. And when deer season came around that year, a couple months after Ron's death, Doug had invited Mark to go hunting opening weekend with him. Doug's stepson, Bobby Brown, would also join them for the trip. Mark Perry ended up having to work that morning on the day of their planned hunting trip. So to start that day, Doug and Bobby had gone together out to Yankee Springs, a large public hunting area north of Kalamazoo. Neither of them got a deer, and around lunchtime, they headed back to Comstock.
I'll never forget him singing in the car that day on the way back from Yankee Springs. Magic carpet ride.
See, y'all were having a good day that day.
Yeah.
We're all getting along.
It was getting along good. I'm glad we was getting along good then.
At the time of the hunting trip, Doug had been married to Bobby's mom, Jan, for 3 years. Bobby and his new stepdad hadn't always gotten along. Tensions between them had led to Bobby moving out of Jan and Doug's house. He was now living with a family friend, and things between Bobby and his stepfather had gotten better.
I didn't live with him.
So that's when it could turn better?
Yep. He wasn't going to tell me what to do.
Y'all got along when you were just hanging out together. It was
When
you were...
He was fun to be around.
Sometime around 1 or 2 p.m. that afternoon, Mark Perry had gone to Doug's place and picked him up with Bobby. The three of them headed off together in Mark's truck for an afternoon hunting trip, destination to be determined.
Where are y'all headed when you take off?
That way, south.
You know where?
Not really. I thought they knew, but they didn't.
So y'all hop in the car and you just head off somewhere?
Yeah.
And hope for the best, and then...
Yeah, and then we seen a farmer on a tractor, and I got out and asked him, and he said there was a spot down the street, and then I kind of realized where I was at, because I went there the year before. I told them that there was a state game area right down the street.
So you didn't even know where you're, like, you're just driving?
They were the adults.
So they hadn't planned this out very well, had they?
No. Nope.
After the farmer pointed them in the right direction, they'd headed down X Avenue, a dirt road that runs right through the middle of the game area and has a few parking spots off of it that hunters could choose from. But when Bobby's group got to the first parking area on X Avenue, they saw that a bunch of hunters were already out there, standing out beside a camper.
So you've seen them, you're like, oh, it's crowded here, let's keep going.
Yeah, I knew that there was another spot just up past that creek where you could pull in. And yeah, that's where we went.
Was there anyone there when you got there?
Nope.
There's no one there.
No.
How sure are you of that?
Positive. We wouldn't have stopped there, I don't think.
After finding an empty parking area on the east side of Bear Creek, the group took that as a sign that they'd found a place to hunt that wouldn't be so crowded. They got out of the truck, loaded their shotguns, and headed back into the field just off of the parking area.
Mark veered off to the right, and Doug kept walking, and I just told him I was going to keep going, try to get away from him, because I'm quiet when I hunt. He's not.
So...
I want to see deer.
Mark Perry went off into the strip of woods that lined the field to the west, while Doug and Bobby kept heading south, past the field and into the strip of woods there. And for a time, Bobby and Doug remained in sight of one another.
I sit there for a while, and then I seen Doug come towards me and sit down. I could hear him rustling candy wrappers and burping. I gotta get away from him. I'm not gonna see anything. So I got him walk back farther.
But it sounds like he's not taking it too seriously.
No. No, which surprised me. I thought he knew how to hunt.
Bobby Brown was taking his hunting very seriously. He was determined to shoot the biggest buck possible that year. And his stepdad's fidgeting was going to seriously interfere with that plan. So Bobby kept heading south until he reached the swamp and could go no further. The trees in that stretch of forest are spaced out enough where you can see quite a ways, especially in November when there's hardly any growth or leaves. But where Bobby was, at the southeast corner of the game area, was far enough away that he could no longer see Doug. For an hour or so, everything was quiet. That's when Bobby heard the shots.
There was a shot, and then somebody yelled something, and then there was another shot. It was
bam.
They weren't too far apart.
Yell, bam.
Yeah, it wasn't that far apart.
And the yell, you couldn't hear.
I couldn't make it out.
Couldn't? Was it Doug, do you think? Doug.
I couldn't even tell you. I just heard someone yell something. It was short, whatever they said.
To Bobby, those two shots had been a reason for optimism, not concern. The yell he'd heard had been indistinct, but it hadn't sounded panicked or fearful.
I figured it was coming from the direction that Doug was at. I figured he got a deer. I thought, well, I know who gets to drag that to the truck.
You?
Yeah.
I mean, he could have missed the first shot, but the second one he must have gotten it, right?
Right, that's what I figured. And that's what I figured I was walking back to, was him getting a deer.
Bobby didn't head back toward Doug right away, though. If the hunter who'd fired the shots had missed with both, there was a chance the deer could be heading Bobby's way. It was while he was still waiting to see if those two shots would spook a deer in his direction that Bobby also heard something else. A car, speeding down the road not far from where he was hunting. In 2002, Bobby told detectives he'd heard it maybe 10 or 15 minutes after the shots had been fired. It had sounded to Bobby like it was heading off to the east somewhere.
Because I heard it go around that corner.
And what do you think it was?
A Oldsmobile. I could be wrong, and I don't know why I thought that, but there had to have been a reason.
What do you think the noise was being made because of?
I just figured it was some young kid out beating the piss out of his car. I could tell they were spinning the tires.
Not long after that, Bobby started walking north, back in the same direction he'd come from earlier. He was still hoping to find his stepdad busy gutting a deer.
I got up to where I could see orange, and I thought, when it's warm out, but why the hell did he take his coat off? So it looked like it was laying on the ground. I thought, why did he take his orange coat off? That don't make sense. And I got a little closer and seen, I thought, who's playing this sick joke? This shit ain't funny. And then I realized it was Doug, and who is this person?
It took Bobby several moments to understand what had happened. There was Doug, lying on the ground and tangled up with a log. And then there was another man, not far away, lying between two trees. Neither were moving. Bobby ran to his stepdad, trying to figure out what was wrong.
I pulled him out and see if he had a pulse. And I was looking, I couldn't figure out what happened to him. I just knew he had blood coming out of his mouth and stuff. And I didn't see no bullet hole in him, but he was, like, in my lap.
Even though Bobby couldn't tell what was wrong with Doug, it was obvious what had happened to the other man, the one that Bobby didn't know. He had been shot straight through, with bullet wounds on both his chest and back.
I was trying to figure out what happened and what, where, did they shoot each other? That's what I thought at first. What the hell? What happened? It didn't make sense. That's when I remembered that Mark was with us, and I ran and got him. But
were you screaming? Were you yelling?
Oh, yeah.
What were you saying?
I was yelling, I'll kill you, because I didn't know if there was somebody behind the tree right there. I knew that I didn't think they could have gotten far. You know, that I'm sure they could have gotten a long ways by then, but I didn't know what happened. I just was scared.
It wasn't hard for Bobby to find Mark. He was still where they'd left him, in the thin woods along the edge of the field they first walked into when they'd arrived that afternoon.
I knew about where he was at, and I just was running that way, and yelling his name, and he seen me, and stood up and started folding up his little chair, and he had a big ass smile on his face because I think he thought I got a deer. And I told him what happened. Like, I just found Doug and he's dead. He's like, what? Take me to him. And he like went into shock. He just started crying, holding him and rocking. And I thought, well, I was thinking you're the one supposed to keep your shit together right now, not me.
But he's not.
No. He wasn't even listening to me at that point. I don't know. I thought he would hold it together better than that. Better than me. The only reason I did though is because I knew I had to get home to my mom. I felt bad for my mom. I knew she was going to freak out.
So you're not even thinking call the cops. You're thinking...
Why? They're calling the ambulance or whoever comes to get... I don't like cops. I wouldn't call them for nothing. But you're right. Somebody should have called them.
But at that moment, your brain's thinking, Mom.
What happens next is hard to piece together, at least in terms of a precise sequence of events. We know generally what happened. Bobby and Mark rolled Doug onto his back. They tried to find a pulse, but couldn't find one. They checked the other man for a pulse, but couldn't find one for him either. And then at some point, both Bobby and Mark left in search of help. But they didn't go together.
It's hard to tell from your statements and Mark's statements what happened. Like, in this time period, it seems like both of y'all are...
in shock.
And you seem to have a little less awareness of what's going on. And neither of you remembers when the other leaves. Both of you remember leaving, but neither of you is really aware of where the other is at the time.
Yeah, which is dumb. It's just stuck together.
It's not dumb. You're just reacting.
Yeah.
We know Mark Perry headed towards the sound of the hammering, where he found Ron Elwell working on his cabin, and the two of them went back to where the bodies were. And we know that at some point, either before or after Mark Perry had left, Bobby also left. His only plan at that point was to somehow find a phone so he could call his mom and tell her what happened.
So what happened on your way back out to the road?
I ran into that guy. Had glasses. I thought he had blonde hair. He had an orange hat on, but I could see his hair.
Tell us about that. What did you do?
I said, who the fuck are you? And he said, is someone hurt? And then I told him, no, it's people dead out here.
Did you point the gun?
Oh, yeah.
What'd you do? I wanted
to hear the right answer come out of his mouth. I guess, I don't know.
So you
I was just scared. I couldn't tell you.
You had it pointed.
My gun was always cocked. It's just, I probably had the safety on.
And what does he say?
He asked me to take him to him. Why I did, I don't know. I don't know why I did that. I don't know why the hell I did that. He was no one to me.
But he says, he's the first guy you see, and he says, take me back to the bodies. Or just take me back there.
Show me,
After bringing the man in the orange hat back to the crime scene, Bobby took off again, heading back to the parking area. By then, other people had already started gathering there, mostly other hunters who had heard Bobby's screams and had come by to see if they could help. Bobby doesn't know what happened to the man in the orange hat after that, and whoever he was, he must have already been gone before the police arrived, because he's not mentioned in any of the deputies' reports from that day. And none of the witnesses the police spoke to ever mentioned Bobby pointing a gun at them, so he wasn't any of the hunters that were known to have been in the game area that day. As far as the investigation was concerned, it was as if the man in the orange hat had simply vanished.
Jim Bennett's niece, Stacy, was only 6 years old when her uncle had gone out hunting at the Fulton State game area and never returned. It would be many years before she learned the details about what had happened to him, But recently, while caring for her grandmother, Jim Bennett's mother, she witnessed again the pain and grief that his death had inflicted on her family all those years ago.
It affected her a lot, and now that she has dementia, I don't know if you're familiar with dementia, but yeah. She relived that whole thing last fall about this time. She was reliving it, like she thought it just happened. I didn't know what to do, but she thought it just happened, and she was like traumatized all over again.
Stacy remembers Jim Bennett coming over for Sunday breakfast, and she remembers her mom, Jim Bennett's sister, going over to his house to help out.
She would clean his house for him. She killed an octopus on accident because she used Lysol or bleach or something to clean, and it killed the octopus. He brought an octopus back from Florida.
Like, he caught it?
Yes, he had strange animals.
But he kept it alive.
Yeah,
well, until
did.
Your mom.
he tried. He had a potbelly pig. He had pigeons. I think he had a raccoon at one point. And the octopus. Oh, a goose that we inherited, actually. She was mean. Quackers.
After his death, Jim Bennett's girlfriend and her daughter, Amanda, had become Quacker's new guardians for a time. And Amanda remembers that the goose almost didn't survive the investigation into Bennett's murder.
I just remember that detective coming around a lot when she was around.
I wonder who that is.
He threatened to shoot my goose because I got really upset and started crying.
Because the goose was
he
like...
He pulled the gun on my goose and was going to shoot it.
Just because?
Because my goose was attacking him. She was a guard dog.
Okay.
So.
What Jim Bennett is probably most remembered for by those who knew him was his inventiveness.
No, he was very intelligent, and he could invent things and do things that, you know, a lot of people would never think of. But my mom was telling me about him making kind of like those paper lanterns that people fly now. He made something like that that would fly, and he dammed up the creek and made electricity.
Stacy's childhood memory of her Uncle Jim making a mill to harness the creek's power was accurate, but we later learned wasn't quite the whole story.
I mean, he made a water wheel and made his own gunpowder.
That's Skeeter Cerny. Skeeter, by the way, is not his real name, but it's what pretty much everyone in town knows him as.
He made electricity? Like, I heard someone say he made like a...
I think that's what it started out to be. He was going to, but he couldn't make enough over the stream because it wouldn't go fast enough.
Ah.
So he made the water... No, I think somebody came out and told him he couldn't do it or something, and he decided, I'm going to make some gunpowder. Put some coal together and whatever you mix with coal and sulfur, whatever, to make gunpowder, made gunpowder. Powerful freaking gunpowder.
Gary Krimble also remembers Jim Bennett's homemade gunpowder.
I can't remember going to his house one time. He lived on Bear Creek outside of Leonidas, a little creek which is famous for big snapping turtles and stuff. And we went out to his house at the bar one night, and he just had empty gallon jugs of milk and stuff like that. Show you how to just put a teaspoon of them in that milk jug, stick a fuse in it, put a few rocks so it'd get away from you, and man, it sounded like a stick of dynamite going off.
As for Stacy's memory of her Uncle Jim making paper lanterns, well, when we spoke to Skeeter, he remembered a bit more about that as well.
He'd rocked this whole town. The gravel pits just happened to skip jump over the graveyard.
Oh, so you could hear it.
You could hear it. I mean, them bag bonds would go off, too. He'd let them off at his house and get the wind just right over the town, and they'd go off, and I mean, rattle this whole town. I mean, it was funny. Jim's at it again.
Jim Bennett's inventiveness went beyond his fondness for homemade fireworks. He was a ham radio enthusiast, and at the time of his death, he'd been starting up a business to harvest maple syrup. He also had a pilot's license. It was his mother who taught him to fly. She ran an airstrip on land just behind the trailer where he lived. It was a decent-sized piece of land, long enough for a runway, and Bennett was free to hunt there whenever he wanted.
Which is why it had been so perplexing to Jim Bennett's friends and family that he'd been at the Fulton State game area that day. Wayne Martinka, Bennett's close friend, hadn't known the game area was a place that Bennett would even consider hunting at.
I didn't think he did.
Yeah.
I was surprised that he went there. You know, so I had no need to go state hunting land because I've got my own woods and everything. That was the only thing that I can remember is I never did figure that he'd go there. So I don't know why he decided to. But the most I could say is whoever said something to him said the hunting was good there.
This is something that almost all of Jim Bennett's friends told the police when they were interviewed later on after his murder. Some of his friends even remembered having specific conversations with Bennett about how the game area wasn't a good place to hunt and should be avoided. It made no sense to them that he would have wanted to go there at all, and he certainly had no need to, because unlike Doug Estes, Jim Bennett had plenty of access to private hunting land. In fact, Jim had been deer hunting on his parents' land on the morning of November 17th. His friend Skeeter had been with him.
The other day it happened. I hunted with him that day. We were all supposed to hunt together, and Jim again went on his own. And we sat and waited for him, and we got the news later in the evening that he was shot. And they tried to blame me for the damn thing.
White-tailed deer are creatures of the twilight, most active at dawn and dusk. The scientific term for this is crepuscular. Although deer will also come out to feed in daylight or at nighttime if they have to, given the choice, deer prefer to be out and about during the day's transition periods, when the dark is turning to light or vice versa. Which is why, during hunting season, it's common for hunters to go out in the morning, before the dawn, so they can be in place and ready to shoot as soon as it grows light enough to see the deer around them. Once the morning hunt is over, they will often break for a few hours for lunch before coming back out again in the afternoon in hopes of catching the deer when they emerge at sunset. And that had been the plan for Jim Bennett and his friends on November 17th. They'd hunted together that morning and were supposed to meet up that afternoon to hunt again.
Yeah, we hunted behind Sherry and Jerry's house along the runway. And I sat there and got a deer early in the morning and went and turned it in. And then come back, then we was all supposed to push a cornfield. And the more guys you got, the easier it is. And we waited on him, and he just never showed up, so we took off without him.
So he was supposed to come back.
He was supposed to come back.
After the morning's hunt, Bennett had gone back to his trailer. He'd had some lunch, taken a nap, and been woken up a couple hours later by a phone call. Not long after that, his girlfriend, Kimber Tracy, had returned home after work. Jim Bennett told her he was going out to hunt again, but said he wouldn't be long. He'd be back by around 6:30 that evening. Both Kimber and her daughter Amanda remembered that when Jim Bennett had walked out of the trailer that afternoon, they'd glanced at the VCR clock beside the door and had seen the time. He had left at 4:38 p.m. that afternoon, only 40 minutes before sunset. But this time, Jim Bennett didn't return to Leonidas to hunt with Skeeter and the others. Instead, he got into his Camaro and headed north to the Fulton State game area.
Bennett got a call at lunch, it seems like, and someone said to go hunt at the Fulton State game area. Or that's what he seems to have said to Kimber and them. He said, someone said there's good hunting there, I'm going there.
He didn't tell us if he did. We wouldn't have sat and waited for him. Whatever.
The town of Leonidas is small. It doesn't have any stoplights or gas stations or retail establishments. But it does have the Thunder Hog, the town bar, where Jim Bennett and his friends often gathered. Late on the evening of November 17, 1990, two deputies with the Kalamazoo Sheriff's Department pulled into the Thunder Hog and asked its patrons if there was anyone there who knew Jim Bennett. They needed someone who could come with them to identify his body.
Couldn't believe it. I mean, especially when we heard two people were shot. We're going, man, what the hell went on, you know? I thought maybe in the beginning that Jim and him got in a fight over a deer or something, you know, who shot it or something like that. But how they both got shot, then we heard Jim was shot in the back. Going, what the hell, you know? And then the other guy, I think his name was Estes, right?
Yeah.
Nobody even knew who this guy was, and somebody said he looked like me, that they might have been out there hunting for me. And I'm going, what?
but I can kind of see a little. Yeah. You actually don't look too unlike him.
Yeah, now you say that.
Yeah.
After the murder of Jim Bennett and Doug Estes, all kinds of wild theories started going around Leonidas. Theories like how maybe someone had actually been out there trying to kill Jim Bennett and Skeeter. Only the killer had seen Doug Estes and mistaken him for Skeeter and shot him by mistake. Or theories about how maybe Jim Bennett was the one who'd been shot by mistake and how it was really Doug Estes that the killer had actually been targeting.
There was a scenario too that one of them had to see the other one get shot. And the reason he shot the other one, because he's seen him do it. Have you heard that one?
Yeah, that kind of makes...
That one never made sense to me.
Another theory that had been going around was that it wasn't just a coincidence that led to Doug Estes and Jim Bennett ending up together in the woods that day.
There was umpteen rumors that he was growing pot and somebody stole his... See, Jim grew pot, too.
Yeah, we've heard that.
And someone was stealing his pot or something, or he made a bad dope deal or something, and he... That's about it. The other way around was it was over pot.
Skeeter had known that Jim Bennett grew marijuana. So, at least in theory, the idea of Bennett getting into some kind of dispute over pot hadn't seemed impossible.
He'd pick a cornfield and throw it in the corn.
Oh.
He could start his own plants in that trailer and then take it out and put it in the middle of the corn.
Like any random...
Any place, right.
Did Jim grow especially, like, good or noticeable?
Yes, Jim drew the best pot around. I wish he was still here. I could use some.
So
his pot would make you laugh, and I just love to laugh.
In the file,
help me sleep.
You were quoted at one point saying, like, you had some weed, and you were like, this is Jim Bennett's weed. I'd know it anywhere.
Right. Yes.
You remember that?
Yes.
At times, various detectives who worked on this case have also believed, or have at least considered, the possibility that the deer hunters' deaths were drug-related. Some still believe it's the most likely explanation, though these theories about the murders somehow being drug-related usually didn't involve marijuana. Jim Bennett's close friend, Wayne Martinka, never bought into those particular theories.
Someone described you as probably one of his best friends.
Well, I thought we were good friends. I mean, I'm sure he'd done things I didn't know about, and yeah. I'd done things he didn't know about, but... When they said, well, he was into all this stuff and that, and I go, no, I don't believe it.
What was it? What is all this stuff?
Well, they were saying he was in cocaine and all that stuff, you know.
Who was saying
the cops, that? The cops told me.
That he was into cocaine?
Yeah, that he was in cocaine and they thought it was a drug deal. Okay. And I said, I would have known if he was in that.
Were you aware that he was in weed or growing up? Okay, so that was not a secret.
No, that wasn't a secret. But like I said, I would have known if he was into something.
Another theory that had been going around town was that it was Jim Bennett's friend Skeeter who'd done it. That was something, at least, that Detective Wersema had felt compelled to check out.
I don't remember the detective's name, but he come here bugging me all the different times of the day or whatever. I mean, for 10 years he did this.
When Detectives Ballett and Wersema had gone around Leonidas after the murders, they'd asked people there about Jim Bennett and whether they could think of anyone who might have wanted to kill him. And when they did, Skeeter's name kept coming up. Witnesses told detectives that at least it seemed to them Skeeter was just about the only one who might have been crazy enough to have done such a thing. But none of these witnesses could actually explain why he would have done it. No one knew of any problem that Skeeter might have had with Jim Bennett.
No, we'd never had a problem. It's just that... Fighting in the bars just seemed to follow me. You're getting this kind of, I don't know if you ever watched Richie Cunningham on Happy Days, when Fonzie told him, if you want to make a name for yourself, just hit somebody in school. Well, I did. Beat up one of the jocks, and ever since then, everyone wanted to kick my ass.
The Skeeter theory was another theory that Wayne Martinka had never bought into.
I never was friends with Skeeter Cerny.
Mm-hmm.
I know him and that. But I can't believe Skeeter, it just wasn't that kind of guy.
Yeah.
But I did, now that you mentioned, I did hear somebody talk about that. But, you know, there's always somebody, some rivalry. But, you know, I didn't believe it.
But even as others in town were sometimes suspicious of Skeeter, Skeeter had his own suspicions about some of them.
Remember how Skeeter Cerny had once bought some marijuana and had immediately recognized it as something that Jim Bennett had grown? That whole incident came up in the case file because Skeeter had bought the marijuana not long after Jim Bennett's death, and when he recognized it as something that Jim had grown, Skeeter had immediately become suspicious. He wondered how the person he'd obtained it from had gotten it, and if it was somehow connected to Jim's death. But as it turned out, Skeeter's suspicions weren't justified. There was a good explanation for why Jim Bennett's weed was still being sold. After Jim's death, Kimber and Amanda had gone to stay with some friends for a while, leaving all of Bennett's weed back at the trailer they'd shared. Kimber had nothing to do with Jim Bennett's marijuana business. She had no idea what to do with the weed that he left behind, and she was afraid of getting in trouble for it if the police found it while investigating his death. Kimber's daughter Amanda remembers how she sought help from two of Jim Bennett's friends who'd agreed to go back to the trailer and remove it for her before the police could find it.
That night, apparently, your mom talked to some of Jim's friends and had them go in and get some weed out of the house.
Oh, yeah.
You didn't know about that.
Yeah. Well, there was a lot.
Apparently. How much are we talking here?
Okay, so he had an old trailer behind our trailer, and it had it had big freezers in there, and then there was a big barn that had freezers.
Oh, so there's two buildings.
Yeah, there's two buildings.
Jim Bennett's weed was not, in itself, of particular concern to the detectives who were working on the case. This was a homicide investigation, after all, and as long as it was not connected to the murders, they didn't care why Bennett's marijuana had turned up missing or where it had gone after. But this whole story about the weed being cleared out of Bennett's trailer became relevant when Jim Bennett's girlfriend, Kimber Tracy, told investigators there had been something else that had gone missing from the trailer at around the same time.
I can't remember who she told, but it's in the report, obviously, that the information didn't come out, I think, to Bruce for quite some time, that Bennett had put a cassette tape and a small firearm between the mattresses of their bed, and he told both Kimber and her daughter, if anything ever happens to me, Skeeter did it. And, you know, there's a cassette tape under the bed between the mattresses that'll explain why. Now, when that was in relation to when the shooting occurred, I don't know, but I don't think it was too much time had passed. I don't think it was relatively new. But when they went to check, it was gone.
Detective Madison's memory of the reports is slightly off here. Kimber did tell the police about how, shortly before his death, Jim Bennett had recorded a cassette tape and hid it under their mattress, and how he told her that if anything had happened to him, she should listen to it. But at least according to the police reports, it wasn't Skeeter that Kimber said the tape had been about. What Kimber said is she thought that Bennett had told her the tape was about someone named Terry, though Bennett hadn't specified the last name and she wasn't entirely sure who he'd meant. Still, whoever it was exactly that Bennett had named, it hadn't been Skeeter.
So here's one thing that's in the case file that's kind of weird to me. So when Jim died, Kimber told the police that before he died, he heard the story, he took a tape recorder and recorded something and said, something happens to me, give this to the police.
What?
That's news to you? No one ever asked you about that?
No.
Well, Kimber says that the tape disappeared. So she never, and she says she never listened to it, but I'm kind of like, who would not listen to it? Seriously, though, who wouldn't listen to a tape like that? Well, Kimber, apparently, would not. And after Jim died, when Kimber finally did try to listen to it, to find out what message Jim had left her from beyond the grave, the cassette was gone. Which is why, for a time, the detectives had been interested in this whole story about the two guys who had gone to Kimber and Jim's trailer and helped clear out the marijuana from the freezers there. I've spoken to both the guys who helped Kimber out by taking the pot out of the trailer, and both deny removing any cassette tapes while they were there. Actually, they deny even knowing that such a cassette tape ever existed. I have no reason to dispute them on that.
He did say he was there that night.
He did admit going in and getting the weed out. Like, he had no hesitation. Yeah, he's like, yeah, we went and cleaned it out.
I don't think my mom was in the house with them.
No.
Because she said that the pistol that was under the bed come up missing, and
she did say that.
Yeah. So I don't think she was with them.
When Kimber and Amanda were informed of Jim's death, they left to stay with friends, and it was weeks before they returned again. There was plenty of time for anyone to have gotten in there to take the cassette and the gun. And today, Amanda doesn't recall anything about a cassette tape that was kept under a mattress.
Though she did recall something else.
I had a tape. I don't know about which one.
But there was a
about.
Tape recorder that can record conversations. So okay. He could have made a tape, it sounds like, for sure.
Oh, I'm thinking you guys are talking about one of them little ones.
Maybe.
Because he had one of the little ones, and he had a whole bunch of those tapes.
Do you know where he kept those?
Now I know what tapes you're talking about. He had a whole bunch of them. They were like this big.
If Jim Bennett really did have a cassette tape that had all the answers, well, it's long gone now. And any answers about what happened to him and to Doug Estes will have to be found elsewhere. Like at the crime scene. And the evidence there that the killer couldn't take with him. Next time, on Undisclosed. That's all for episode 2 of season 5 of Undisclosed on the case of Jeff Titus. We'll be back next Monday with episode 3, and don't forget to send us your questions for our addendum episode this Thursday. Methil Telhan is our executive producer. Our logo was designed by Baluki, and our theme music is by Ramiro Marquez. Audio production is by Rebecca Lavoie of Partners in Crime Media, host of the Crime Writers On podcast. And music in this episode is by Blue Dot Sessions. Transcripts for this episode will be available on our website at undisclosed-podcast.com. And they're prepared by our amazing transcript team, Brett Bliss, Erica Fladell, Don Logus, and Skylar Park. And of course, thank you to all of our sponsors for making it possible for us to come back week after week. You can follow us online and on social media. Our handle is @UndisclosedPod. We're on Instagram, Facebook, and Twitter. And if any of our listeners out there have information on Jeff Titus's case that they'd like to share, we'd love to hear from you. You can reach us at undisclosedpodcast@gmail.com, or you can call and leave a message at 410-205-5563. That's all for this week, and thanks so much for listening.